We've been looking, for those of you, just to kind of recap where we are on a Tuesday night, we've been looking at stories and symbols of the Buddhist tradition, actually, and others. So stories and symbols to illustrate certain dharmic points. At the moment, we've been going through stories and symbols to do with the system of spiritual development as explained by Sangharakshita. Just as a framework, really. We've looked at stories and symbols to do with integration, stories and symbols to do with positive emotion. And now we've grouped together the stories and symbols to do with spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. Because in a way, when we try to look at like which one's a spiritual death and which one's a spiritual rebirth, well, you can't really have spiritual death without spiritual rebirth. So we decided to lump them all together. And last week... I hear that Vidanya was talking about, I don't know if he phrased it like this, but people who got stuck in a rut, people who got stuck in a rut spiritually. And he looked at Huan Sung and Naropa as examples of people, examples of what happens when your spiritual practice gets a bit stuck, when what the spiritual practice that's meant to liberate you from worldly concerns becomes a worldly concern. And instead of being a means of liberation, becomes a means of kind of worldly entanglement. And, well, I don't know what happened last week, but when Vidanya was telling me this over the phone, I got really quite excited. And I thought, well, that's just really good, isn't it? Yeah, let's just go and be really radical Buddhist heroines and heroes, and let's leave behind all that kind of mundane, bureaucratic, boring planning department of the spiritual life. Let's just close down the planning department and let's just go forth as spiritual heroes and heroines and live happily ever after. So I should imagine that all that very same thought process went on in everyone else as well. I suppose what happens is, like, well, this is me, but I get really gung-ho about things and I think, yeah, let's go and transform the universe and become a bodhisattva. And I have these really high ideals. And then part of me is standing behind going, yeah, well, she'll calm down in a minute. And when she does, I'll come back again. There's bits of me that actually just don't want to do that kind of thing. So there's the bits of me that realise, well, actually, yeah, I kind of want to do that and I kind of don't. And there's other bits of me that think, yeah, let's go and be a bodhisattva, and then realise just how far away from being a bodhisattva I really am. So, yeah, I know Arloka, who's a Buddhist order member who paints a lot of pictures, and he's quite a dude, actually. A lot of really good quotes you hear from Arloka, someone says, oh, Arloka says this, and you think, what a dude. And he probably never, ever said it. But anyway, so the urban myth goes, Arloka once said that responsibility is like a beam of light. And the more responsibility you take, the bigger the beam of light. And the more the beam of light shows up all the murky areas of your life. And I think that that's the same with inspiration. The greater the beam of inspiration shines on your life, the more it's going to show up all those dark corners. So, in a way, the point of this talk is it's called Bad Guys. And it's a kind of... We're going to look a little bit at some of the people in the Buddhist tradition who you couldn't possibly have done any worse than them, but they managed it, so can you, is the general gist. Yeah, there's some people in the Buddhist tradition, a lot of examples, actually, of people who've been really bad. Like, you might all think that you've been bad, but I suppose I can't imagine that any of you have killed 108 people and strung up their fingers around your neck as a kind of necklace. Anyone done that? No? Good, right. So yeah, you're in good company. Didn't mean to sound like that, but anyway. So first of all, I'm going to talk about one of the most famous of the bad guys of the Buddhist tradition, which is Milarepa, who was a Tibetan yogi who lived in the 11th century in Tibet. And the story of Milarepa is pretty much this. His father was a fairly wealthy local landowner with a nice house, and he had a wife and his son, Milarepa, and a daughter as well. But unfortunately, the father got sick, and Milarepa was still just a boy at the time. So the father realised he was going to die, and he said to well, you know, I'll hand over all my property to Milarepa, but obviously he's not old enough to take care of it now. So he entrusted it to his brother, to Milarepa's aunt and uncle, to look after his property until Milarepa came of an age when he could take it over and manage it for himself. So with that in mind, having got all his affairs sorted, he died. And almost immediately, what the aunt and uncle did was that they took over all the land and property for themselves and basically made Milarepa, his mother and his sister, into their slaves. They were ejected from their old rooms, their old privileges, and they were dressed in rags and made to work for the aunt and uncle. So understandably, Milarepa's family, his mother and his sister, were very bitter about this, but particularly his mother. You get this impression of quite a woman, actually, Milarepa's mother. She was not a force to be messed with, and she was really mad. She was really mad. She was a bit like in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Is that it? Anyway, that film. He calls her a poison dragon, and I thought that was really good. It was like Milarepa's mother is like a poison dragon, and she's not going to rest until she has her revenge. So what she does is she sends Milarepa off to learn the dark arts from a local sorcerer. So Milarepa goes off dutifully, goes and learns the dark arts off a local sorcerer, and at the right moment seeks his revenge. So his uncle, his uncle's eldest son, was going to get married, and it was a big affair, and the whole village was invited. They were all invited to this big house that was the uncle's, but used to be Milarepa's father's. And right at the right moment, when they were just all gathered inside the house, Milarepa created these enormous bugs. I don't know why he created the enormous bugs, but there were these enormous bugs. They were like these giant scorpions and centipedes and, I mean, just completely grim, sort of like some horrible horror movie, locusts and things like that, spiders. And the house got filled with all these giant bugs. And it frightened all the horses in the stable, so that the horses in the stable kicked over the central pillar to the house and the whole house collapsed, killing most people inside. So it killed, basically, it killed 35 people, apparently, including most of his uncle's family, but not his uncle and not his aunt. And in a way, it's a classic example of hatred leading to hatred. There's a famous quote from the Buddha that says, hatred can never be conquered by hatred. It can only be conquered by love. So the more hatred you put into a situation, the more hatred that's just going to spark off in other people. So Milarepa killed all these people in the village, and the village obviously then wanted to seek their revenge against Milarepa and against his mother and his sister. So his mother entreated Milarepa. She said, well, you've got to, this isn't enough. You're going to have to seek more revenge on this village. So she sent him off to another teacher to learn the dark art of creating hailstorms. Apparently this was quite a frequent, well-known thing in Tibet, that you had to pay someone off so that they wouldn't cause a hailstorm. So anyway, so she sent him off to this master who taught him how to create hailstorms. And just as the moment was right, they'd had a bumper harvest and they were all going to pick it on the same day. And just before that day came, he let loose this hailstorm and destroyed the village's entire crops. So not only had he killed all these people, but he'd actually destroyed their livelihood as well. And at that point, I think he just really, it was almost like you see Milarepa getting swept along, particularly by his mother. And he suddenly realises just what he's done, just what enormous suffering he's done to people, not only through killing them, killing their families, but also through destroying their livelihood. There's something very human about, you know, crops, people living off the land, and just destroying that whole way of life for them. It was a terrible thing to do. So he started to feel quite a lot of remorse. And there's this quote for him from his biography, which is quite a good read, actually. It's in the library. And he says, I deeply repented the destruction and mischief I had wrought by sorcery in the killings of so many of mine enemies and in producing hailstorms. I longed so for religion that I forgot to eat. In the daytime I wished to be sitting down when I was going about, and to be going about when I was sitting down. At night I was unable to sleep. I was thus full of remorse and repentance, and yet I could not bring myself to ask my teacher to allow me to adopt a religious life. So you get this sense of a man deeply, deeply troubled by what he's done. So troubled he couldn't sit down, he couldn't sleep, he couldn't eat. And luckily what happened was actually his teacher also felt remorse. His teacher had a sudden insight into the impermanence of all things and realised what suffering he'd caused by practising sorcery, and said to Milarepa, well, not only am I going to have to reap the effect of all my unskillful actions, but I've also encouraged you to do the same thing as me. So I'm going to have to reap the effects of that as well. I've just not only destroyed my life, but I've destroyed your life as well. So he said, well, one of us has got to go and lead the religious life. So he actually gave Milarepa his blessing and sent him off to find a teacher. He sent him off with all these kind of gifts that one would give a teacher when you ask for the teachings. So Milarepa searched for a teacher, and he found a teacher called Marpa, who in fact was Naropa's student, who we talked about last week. So he found Marpa, and in a way the rest is history. He got the teachings, he got enlightened. Except for it wasn't quite as simple as that. He still had a few more trials to go, and Marpa was no soft target. So Milarepa, the story goes, Marpa just made him build all these towers. And as soon as he'd kind of got three quarters of the way out building these towers, Marpa would come up and go, what are you doing? And Milarepa, I'm building a tower. You told me to build a tower. And he'd say, what are you talking about? I never asked you to build a tower. What are you doing? Take it down. Bring all the stones back. So Milarepa would go, right, okay, and, you know, take all these stones down. And then Marpa will come up to him and go, oh yeah, no, I think what we'll do is we'll build a house right here, and this is what it's got to look like, and this is how big it's got to be. So Milarepa will go, right, okay. And then Marpa would say, well, you know, and if you do that, I'll give you the teachings afterwards. So Milarepa would get all these stones and he'd build up all these buildings. And then Marpa will come up and go, what are you doing? Well, you told me to build a tower. And Marpa would say, oh my God, you didn't take me seriously, did you? I was drunk. What are you doing? You've got to take it down. You've got to put all those stones back. So Milarepa would dutifully take all the stones back. And it would happen again and again and again. He'd say, Marpa, will you give me the teachings? And Marpa would say, yeah, I'll give you the teachings. I just want you to build this house right here. And when you've done that, I'll give you the teachings. So Milarepa would go off, start building this house. And Marpa will go up and go, well, what are you doing? And then Milarepa will say, well, you told me to build this house. Marpa would go, no, I don't think I really thought it through, actually. So it went on and on and on like this. And Milarepa got these enormous sores on his back. In fact, it was said that his whole back was just basically one big sore. So he was doing all this very, very heavy labour on his own. And eventually what happened was that Marpa's wife took pity on Milarepa. And Marpa's wife helped Milarepa escape to another teacher to get the teachings off another teacher. And Marpa found him and got him to come back. And it's quite an important moment, actually, in his story, because Marpa says, "It's such a shame you didn't just trust me. It's such a shame, because what I knew that you didn't know is that you had to be filled with despair 9 times. 9 times in your life you had to be filled with utter despair at your own actions, at ever being able to realise the truth, at ever being able to get enlightened. And only when you experienced that 9 times would you be able to be ready for the teachings." And what happened in the end was actually he'd only experienced it 8 times. So he had 1 more time to go. So it's quite a thing, isn't it? To be filled with absolute, utter despair at least 9 times in his life before he'd be able to be receptive to the teachings. Like being in utter despair once in your life, feeling so hopeless that you could never, ever experience the teachings. You could never realise the teachings, that all you'd done was wreak havoc on the world. To experience that once in your life, I think, would be enough for me, actually. But Milarepa had to go through it 9 times. So, in a way, all this thing about Marpa and Milarepa was that it was really important that Milarepa really faced the consequences of his actions, that he really saw the consequences of his actions. Because until he really saw the consequences of his actions, he wouldn't be able to progress. There would be no progression. And in fact, in a way, what these stories, all these stories have this same theme. Because the best thing that can happen to you in your spiritual life is that you face the consequences of your actions. And the very worst thing that can happen to you in your spiritual life is if you don't face the consequences of your actions. If you can face the consequences of your actions, the rest of the spiritual life will unfold naturally. It's that pivotal moment where you can just face who you've been and where you're going to go. So in a way, facing the consequences of your actions is when the spiritual rebirth happens. It's the spiritual death, but it's also the spiritual rebirth. If you can get that kind of spiritual death, the spiritual death of realising the consequences of your actions, you will be reborn. You're already saved. It will already happen. So it's a really wonderful thing, but it's also exceptionally painful. And especially depending on what you've done in your life, it can be very, very painful. So in a way, this theme of facing the consequences of your actions, facing what you've done in the past, is really important, pivotal thing in the spiritual life. And it's important with the big things, but it's also important with the small things as well. And there's this bit of the story with Milarepa, which I always find really beautiful, actually, is when he does escape to a different master, when Marpa's being really mean to him, and he goes to this other master, and this other master says, "Oh, well, since you can do hailstorms, could you unleash a hailstorm on this village of robbers who've been robbing my disciples?" So Milarepa goes along with this because it's very important that you absolutely place your trust in your master, in your guru. So Milarepa goes along with this. He does this hailstorm on these robbers. And it's terrible for him. It's absolutely terrible for him because he can't, you know, his whole thing is he wants to do good to humanity and not to undertake that unskillful behaviour ever again. And there's this final moment where he meets an old man and his daughter, and he's completely damaged. He's completely wiped out their livelihood. And then he starts seeing dead birds, the birds that have been killed in the hailstorm. And he just sees these little fragile lives that he's destroyed, birds and rats. And he picks up any dead bird and any dead rat that he can find, and he holds them in his robe. And when he gets back to his teacher, he just puts them at the teacher's feet. And he says, "Never, ever make me do that again. I never want to do that again." So it's quite important. It's like, he's killed all these people. And somehow that little fragile life of a little bird or a rat, which, you know, probably people at that time killed anyway, just brought home to him what are the effects of his actions really were. It's very moving, and he just drops them at this guy's feet and says, never make me do that again. So it's really important to realise the consequences of our actions. And what goes along with this as well is that kind of reflection I've been having is about being very careful about protecting yourself and others from the consequences of their actions. I think sometimes if someone says to you, you know, I've done this and I'm really ashamed about it, there's a temptation to go, oh, no, it's all right, it doesn't really matter. And in a way, I think that's spiritually a bit of a disaster if you do that. Because everyone should be able to experience the consequences of their actions, to be able to face up to them with compassion, with forgiveness, with positive emotion. But trying to smooth it away as if it didn't happen. You know, if Marpa had just gone up to Milarepa and went, oh, it doesn't matter, they deserved it anyway, it would have just been awful. Milarepa would have never, ever progressed. So it's important not to try and smooth these things over. There's a story about this as well in the time of the Buddha with Angulimala. So you might have heard of Angulimala. Angulimala means necklace of fingers. And he lived in the forest, and he'd kind of attack stray travellers and kill them, steal their stuff and cut off their finger and wear it in a garland around his neck. And the Buddha converted him to the Dharma. He became one of the Buddha's followers. And there's a whole story about that, which is really great. But what's interesting is the story that came after that. And the story came after that was that Angulimala became a Buddha, follower of the Buddha, quite important follower of the Buddha. I think he even actually became the Buddha's companion, the Buddha's close assistant. And they got to this village where Angulimala had killed loads and loads of people. And the villagers recognised Angulimala, and they started to throw things at him. And they were throwing stones at him. And the Buddha just said, bear it, brother, bear it. And I think that's really interesting, because what I would have wanted to do is protect Angulimala. But the Buddha just stood back and he said, bear it, brother, bear it. Bear the consequences of your actions. So it's quite a hard truth, but in a way I can see what he was trying to do. He was trying to tell Angulimala, the most important thing is that you face up to what you've done. So the basic dharmic truth is that actions have consequences. Actions have consequences at far deeper levels than we ever, ever realise. But that's what happens. Actions have consequences. And it's also important to say not just bad actions have consequences, good actions have consequences as well. Skillful actions have consequences. You act skillfully, you will experience more and more liberation, and other people will be happier as a result. So in a way, we've got to face this truth. And it might feel like despair. It might feel like a spiritual death. It might make you feel absolutely terrible to realise that actions have consequences, or your actions have consequences. And in some ways, it sort of seems like as soon as you start to notice these things, they seem like they're much worse, like you're getting worse. Well, you're not getting worse, actually. You've just started to notice things a bit more clearly. The beam of light has got bigger, and it's illuminated those dark and murky corners in your life. Sangharaksha talks a lot about, well, you also need those moments of feeling completely and totally inadequate, those moments of despair. Because if you don't have those moments of despair where you feel like, actually, all I've caused is suffering in my life, and I just don't know how I can practice the Dharma. I just can't see how I could practice the Dharma. Unless you have those moments in your life, the Dharma will be just something that you're very good at, that you appropriate to yourself, you know, like I'm so greedy because I can practice the Dharma. So he says you've got to realise your own spiritual impotence before you can move forward. You get results only after you have put all your energy into something, failed, and given up or given in. So, spiritually speaking, those moments that Milarepa had of complete despair, of feeling utterly impotent, and really seeing the consequences of his actions, were the best moments that he'd ever had. So in that letting go, in that spiritual death, when you cease to justify your behaviour, when you stop trying to make it all right and smooth it over, when you say, actually, this is what I've done, and this is the consequences of that, that's when you can start to move forward. So, well, why is that? So I'm just going to look a little bit at why that is. And to do that, to look at some Sanskrit words. There's this word here, which is kalkritya. And kalkritya is the Sanskrit for remorse. So Subhuti talks about remorse. He's written a really good article about this. And he talks about remorse as the pain of the colliding forces of our aspirations of who we want to be, colliding with our own greed, hatred and delusion. So he says, out of these tremendous forces, a longing for what is possible, a longing for the Dharma, a longing to be fulfilled in that kind of way, longing for your own potential for limitless wisdom and limitless compassion, that collides with this realization, well, that's all very well, but look at me now. And look at what I'm doing with my life. And he says, when those two really extreme forces collide, remorse arises, kalkritya arises. And as I was looking at this, I was thinking, actually, this answers quite an important question for me in a particular kind of way. Because I've always wondered, some of you will know this, some of you won't, but there's a thing called the 12 positive nidanas, or the spiral path. And the spiral path starts off with dukkha. And dukkha means unsatisfactoriness. It can also mean suffering. It's a state where you, maybe you're feeling a bit of that despair that Sangharakshita talks about, that Milarepa had. And it says that out of that sense of unsatisfactoriness, out of that sense of suffering, arises shraddha, which is sometimes translated as faith, but that's not... doesn't have the same connotations as in Buddhism as it does in Christianity. Faith in Buddhism means confidence, trust. It's when your understanding of something meets your emotional resonance with that thing. So it's like when you're understanding, oh yeah, the Dharma is true, comes together with a kind of lucidity, emotional lucidity, that you really want the Dharma and a longing to see it through. So faith in Buddhism is based on reason, or understanding, emotions, and a kind of longing, a kind of intuition that something's possible. And the kind of teaching is that it's this sense of unsatisfactoriness or suffering that leads to shraddha, that gives rise to shraddha. And I always think about this because I think, well, yeah, but loads of people suffer, and they're not all getting enlightened, are they? It's like everyone suffers, but it doesn't always lead to faith. It doesn't always lead to shraddha. It doesn't always lead to that real aspiration for the spiritual life, that real longing for the spiritual life. So why is it that some people's suffering really leads to a longing for the spiritual life, and some people's suffering just makes them completely miserable? And I think in a way kalkritya might be a bit of an answer to this. Because kalkritya is saying that, well, it's like when dukkha meets faith a bit. It's when you can experience your faith because you really experience the dukkha, you really experience the suffering. You see that actions have consequences. You see how much of your life is governed by greed, hatred and delusion. And it's that meeting this desire for something a bit better that gives rise to kalkritya, gives rise to remorse, but also a sense that, yes, I will do this. And in a way, it shows into light, it brings into light your own faith. Because it's very important in Buddhism that they're not something that the Buddha has added on to human beings. In a way, it's a very, very human, it's part of human nature to long for spiritual development. And all that remorse does is it shines a light on that, because it shows these two opposing forces of your longing for what is possible, your spiritual aspirations, and where you are now. So, so it's a bit like dukkha has to have a bit of kalkritya in it. Dukkha has suffering has to have a bit of remorse in it before it can lead to faith, before it can lead to shraddha. And without shraddha, there's no spiritual life. Without shraddha, there's not enough emotional weight behind your aspirations to make them move forward. So in a way, that's another talk in itself, because Buddhist shraddha is a whole big area, which I don't have time to go into now. But it's very important. It's like the guts behind the spiritual life. It's like that the kind of steam tanker of the spiritual life that just propels you through the waters. And you need that in order to get enlightened. You need shraddha. And in order to turn your experience of suffering into that faith, into that kind of shraddha, you need to experience some remorse. So kalkritya, or remorse, is kind of the key, actually. It's the key to the whole business of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. It's the key that transforms your suffering, particularly the suffering that comes from your own unskillful actions, into spiritual rebirth, into shraddha. And it's a good thing, because we've all got it. And we've all got a sense of remorse, because we all have a sense of ethical... we all have an ethical sense. We all have a sense of longing for what is beautiful, longing for what is good. We all have a sense of what is good. And normally what happens is this sense of ethical rightness, of ethical purity, is buried under all sorts of other opposing forces, like greed, like hatred, and like delusion. But there's something about a kind of Buddhist practice that can open you up, that can remove all those things and allow you to just experience that ethical state, that natural ethical state of humanity as it is. So you might be thinking, yeah, well, suffering doesn't always have to be my fault. Suffering doesn't always have to be a result of my own unethical actions. So kalkritya can be looked at in three ways. It can be looked at as being ethical, neurotic, or functional. These are Subhuti's terms, but I think they're quite helpful. So it can be looked as being positive, negative, or neutral. So neutral kalkritya, or neutral remorse, is... just when we think we've done wrong in a practical way. So it's that kind of feeling where you think, have I locked the door? And in a way, it doesn't have a big kind of ethical status, because it's just one of those things that you might have forgotten to do. It's like that kind of nagging anxiety in the back of your mind. So there's that kind of remorse, which is just neutral. And in a way, with that kind of remorse, well, you either have to put it right, or if you can't put it right, you just let it go. So you either have to go and check the door, and if you're not in a position to check the door, well, there's nothing you can do about it until you get home and find out that your house has been robbed. So unskillful remorse, though, and there is such a thing as unskillful kalkritya, is what Subhuti calls neurotic. It's when we feel that we've done wrong, we feel that we've done something unskillful, but in fact we haven't done anything unskillful. And usually that's based in a fear of punishment. It's based in a fear of breaking the taboos of society. It's based in the fear of not being accepted. It's based in the fear of love being in some way withdrawn. So it's when we feel like we've done something wrong, but actually, from an ethical standpoint, we haven't done anything wrong. So it's a kind of feeling of anxiety that's dictated to by the conventions of society. So an example of this would be homosexuality. That you can think homosexuality is wrong. You can think it's a bad thing. I've done something unskillful. And actually, from a Buddhist standpoint, in itself, there's nothing unethical about homosexuality. It's just one of those things. It's got a neutral ethical status. But we can get really caught up in about it, you know, that, you know, you might have had feelings for someone of the same sex, and then, you know, your mind goes around and round and round like you've done something really wrong or really unethical. And actually, from a Buddhist standpoint, well, actually, you haven't. That's not a state of mind based in greed, hatred, or delusion. So what can happen to us is that we can think, you know, we've had a lot of these pressures to do good in society, through our family, through our schools, through society, whatever. And you can feel like, you just want to be liberated from all of that. So there's a great sense of freedom in just letting go of the whole confines of society. Let go of society's values. I'm just going to do what I want. And some of that's really good. And some of that is a bit throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Because actually, there is a natural ethical state that can be very positive. It can be positive to feel an ethical remorse. And so the answer is not to just abandon remorse altogether, abandon ethics altogether. So it's a bit like, you know, you can end up in this space saying, yeah, but I'm free. Just don't tie me down with all your notions. Because I'm just so spontaneous, man. And I'm just free to do whatever I want, you know, any time I want. Because I'm just, like, really spontaneous and really authentic. Which, you know, might be harmless enough as an attitude. But it can lead to some really unskillful behaviour that can get you into some nasty messes. So the whole idea of letting go of society's notions about what's right or wrong is not to let go of notions about what's right or wrong altogether. It's just to try and sort out this kind of neurotic remorse from actual real ethical remorse. So ethical remorse is different. It does have a different flavour. It's a function of our natural ethical sensibility. It's a function of our natural desire not to suffer, not to let anyone else suffer. It's a function of our natural desire to spiritually progress that meets the fact that while actually we are suffering, we've made other people suffering, we've caused suffering in our lives, and we're very far from spiritual progression. So it's those two forces that are meeting. A natural ethical sensibility meeting the fact that actually, well, we've made mistakes in our lives and we have caused harm and suffering to other people. So just a bit more Sanskrit words for Becky's sake, because hri and apatrapya. So ethical remorse very much ties in with these two words. Hri means shame, sort of a translation of it would be shame. And it's a recognition, that recognition that you've fallen short of your aspirations. So it's translated as shame, but remember that it's coming from your own natural ethics. It's not coming from what society imposes on you. It's coming from your own understanding of your own ethical sensibilities. So in a way, shame's not a great word for it. But in Buddhism, this is a very, very positive, it's one of the most positive mental states. It might be painful to experience, but it's spiritually very, very positive. And the second word is apatrapya. And apatrapya means a similar thing to shame, but it's kind of when you view your unskillful action in the eyes of someone that you respect. So in modern day life, I think this one's really unpopular. Because we don't like to think about that. We kind of think, yeah, but I don't want to be confined by people's opinions. And actually, it's not going back to ethics being imposed on you from outside. It's actually realizing that there are some people that we respect, some people we even want to be a bit like, and that they exemplify virtues that we want to develop. And it's putting your life in that kind of view, in that kind of framework. So I don't know if you remember on the introductory course, we did this week where you think of someone you admire and think of the ways in which they would behave. And I think that's a really, really good exercise because it shows us that actually there are people that we want to become. There are people we respect and admire. And that's a good thing because they might be able to shine some light for us on our ethical behaviour. So it also highlights something that a kind of truth that we do behave better around some people than others. And you have to take that account into developing a spiritual practice, into developing an ethical practice. And I've got a little, this is going to be a Vajratara, I'm going to start off my Vajratara aphorism book with this aphorism, which is, who you associate with, you will become. Which I think pretty much as far as I can see is true. Who you associate with, you will become. So associate with people who you respect, and you'll become someone who you respect, is the kind of idea. So apatrapia and hui, they're not based in people fear of people punishing us. They're not based in fear of people withdrawing their approval. They're based on our own recognition of who we would like to emulate. So ethical remorse is an immensely positive mental state. It reveals your own aspirations. It reveals your own longing towards the spiritual life by bringing into contact those aspirations with your unskillfulness, your unskillful behaviour. And it also shows that you understood like one of the basic truths about the Dharma, which is that accidents have consequences. It shows that you've really understood that on a certain level. And it's a natural function for a human being. It's a natural ethical sensibility. It's not about society making you feel bad for things that aren't actually wrong, that aren't actually unskillful. But it is painful to bear. It's painful to bear remorse. But I think you've got to remember two things. It's painful to bear remorse, but it's even worse if you try and bury it. If you try and bury it, Subhuti says, it will lead to despondency and self-loathing. Well, that's like piling suffering on top of suffering, actually. Because what you're doing is you're burying your own aspirations. You're burying your own longing for what is possible. And you're burying your own ethical sensibility. And what you do when you do that is you bury your own humanity. So even if it's painful to bear remorse, it's even worse to try and bury it. The end of the story about Milarepa is when he's enlightened and he's got his own disciples. One of the most famous of all his disciples was Gampopa. And at the end of his life, he said to Gampopa, would you like the highest teaching of all? And Gampopa, and he's given him all his teachings. So Gampopa was like, okay, I'm ready now. I'm ready for the highest teaching of all the teachings of all the Buddhas. I'm ready for the highest teaching. And Milarepa turns around and he takes off his shirt. And what's underneath his shirt is a back that's just scarred by all those rocks he carried from Marpa, from all those sores that he had on his back. And it's a bit like he's saying to Gampopa, just remember that actions have consequences and that you have to bear that. And I think that's really moving, actually. That was the highest teaching that he could give his disciples, is that actions have consequences. So it's all a bit heavy. It is all a bit heavy. But there's something else to remember. And there was a time when I was really going through something, and my dear friend Samanata said to me, he said, well, remember, when you're bouncing off the diamond-hard walls of reality, remember the compassion of the Buddhas. And the compassion of the Buddhas is that no one has a fixed and separate and independent self-nature. That actually we're not separate from one another and our nature isn't fixed. And in a way, well, what that means is that no one's evil, actually. No one is evil. I think we can have, I certainly have a view about myself. Even after 12 years of practicing, of 12 years of giving myself to the Dharma, and I've still got this view that everyone else can get enlightened, but somehow I can't, because my nature is inherently evil. That there's something a bit wrong with me. You know, like everyone else is quite spiritually positive and great, and but actually me, it's not really in my nature to be a spiritual person. It's not really, like everyone else can do all that kind of stuff. It's not really in my nature to progress in some way. Which is just such a wrong view. It's just such a load of rubbish. But I think often we can carry around these views. Well, it's okay for everyone else. They can all do it, but I'm just not that special. I'm good at other things. I'm just not that special. So, no one is the inheritor of darkness. And everyone can change. So the compassion of the Buddhas recognises that because no one has a fixed nature, everybody can change. Everybody can change. Everybody can get enlightened. Even Milarepa, even Angulimala can get enlightened. So in a way, well, there's no excuses, is there really? If Milarepa can do it, well, I think we can pretty much all do it. And it also says that, okay, well, our natures aren't separate from one another. So that if we are going to change, we need certain conditions. And change isn't going to come out of the blue. And one of those conditions is Kalkritya. One of those is actually realising what we've done and feeling some sort of remorse for that. One of the conditions is free, or shame. And one of the conditions is apatrapya as well. Realising that that the people around us influence who we are. So I think another key for getting over this kind of remorse and getting over that kind of sense of ethical shame is to associate with people who practice your level of ethics or even above your level of ethics, to associate with those kind of people that actually you want to become. Who can share your spiritual life with you. Because the main way of recognising what's irrational, what's neurotic remorse, and what's rational or ethical remorse, is by checking it out with someone else. By actually opening up to other people and saying, well, you know, I feel really guilty about this. And sometimes if you do that to people, they go, you know, that really isn't anything to feel guilty about. And it can just clear the whole thing. So we need to involve other people in our spiritual life in some way, particularly to distinguish between neurotic and ethical remorse. But also, just to get them to give us a hand, just to discuss ethics, to talk about our ethical practice, and to share that kind of life, to associate with people who aspire to better things. And if we associate with those kind of people, we'll become those kind of people. So both Milarepa and Angulimala recognised this. Milarepa found his teacher. He stuck with his teacher and he stuck with his teacher's disciples throughout his whole spiritual career. And Angulimala, where he left the forest and he joined the community of the Buddha's disciples. You need other people to help you in your spiritual life. But even though we need conditions to help us with our remorse, to help remorse lead to Shraddha or faith, we also need to realise that we just need enough. Okay, we don't need to be perfect. We don't need to be a shining example of the spiritual life and a spiritual goody-two-shoes. We don't want any Buddhist goody-two-shoes terribly much. You just need enough, actually, to be able to progress, to be able to face up to your remorse with kindness and with dignity and with honesty. And if you can do that, you're already saved. The momentum of the spiritual life will just keep carrying you. That's all you need to do. It's just enough. So I'll just finish off by a quote from the Buddha. Talking to someone, I don't know what this bloke did, but anyway, he's talking to someone who's committed an unskillful action. And he says, surely, Badali, a transgression came over you. But since you see your transgression as such and make amends in accordance with the Dharma, we forgive you. For it is growth in the Noble One's discipline when one sees one's transgression as such and makes amends in accordance with the Dharma and by undertaking restraint for the future. So it's for your own good, it's for your own growth in your Noble One's discipline when one sees one's transgression as such. That's all you need to do.